Public Employee Retirement System, and 2004 was the first thing up on our agenda. The Dash 11 amendments are being copied right now, and we had somebody sign up to testify on House Bill 2008, and he's come a little bit away, not too far away, but so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2008 and ask Francis, is it Charbonnet?
Right.
To come on up and share his thoughts with us. He's spent a fair amount of time because I know you've written to me before. And after this, we will then go to House Bill 2004 when we get those amendments. And I would like to, committee, I would like to pass out House Bill 2004 today after we've gone through the Dash 11s. Dash 11s basically are some cleanup language trying to make things a little bit more clear. And I'm sure Dave Hendricks will take us through them. He's done a mighty impressive job trying to get those out today. So, Francis, with that, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and gentlemen of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you briefly about PERS. I've been a school board member in McMinnville for about 22 years overall, and I've been on the board of directors of OSBA for 4 years. I'm, of course, very concerned, as are many of us, with the current financial situation of the PERS system. In my own district, on July 1 of this year, our rates, the employer contribution rates, are going to increase from 12.7% to 18.58%. Our district, therefore, next year will pay PERS an additional $1.3 million in contributions. And of course, because we won't have any more money to offset that, that means that we will have to lay off 20 to 25 employees, school employees, in order to pay for the increased first contributions. This is, of course, a very bad situation, and this appears to be just the beginning. According to PERS own studies, employer contribution rates will likely increase to about 30% in about 8 years and remain there for about 10 years. And of course, replacement ratios for employees with 30 years of credited service are already above 100% on average and are expected to increase about 50% in the next 8 or 10 years. So this is a very drastic situation, and therefore the system is financially out of control and urgently needs reform. And of course, with prompt or thorough reform of the system, we might have a new PERS system which would serve well all employees, either present or future employees, and therefore you might say that successor plans would not be needed. On the other hand, it is very possible that successful reform of PERS would not be possible, or otherwise might be not go through the courts. And in such a case, I believe personally, and this is my main interest, that the PERS system then should be terminated, and that at that time then we would have to consider some successor plans which would be available to all employees. And so one concern that I have with the two bills that you have is that those bills only are effective for people who would become members of PERS after January 1, 2004, and I really don't think that they are particularly useful. It seems to me that if we have successor plans that are going to be used, that those successor plans will have to be because we have had to terminate the present system, and therefore they should be available to all employees, not just future employees. And we're certainly reminded of what happened in 1995. At that time, the assets and liabilities of the PERS system were increasing very, very rapidly. There were some concerns that if we had bad stock market years, that the system might be in trouble, and therefore we created Tier 2 employees. And those Tier 2 employees did not have the 8% guarantee. Well, disaster has struck, and if you analyze the fact that we have now an unfunded actuarial liability of about $15 or $16 billion at the end of 2002, and the fact that we did have Tier 2 employees, which are now about 30 or 40% of the employees in the system, has only reduced that unfunded liability by about 5%. So obviously, it did not have much of an effect in protecting the taxpayers from, the consequences of a financial crisis at first. I believe, by the same token, that creating Tier 3 employees is not going to have a visible effect. We have to fix the main system for all employees. Okay, but having said that, there certainly is a possibility that we will have to consider successor systems. And I think there's general agreement that a sound retirement plan must use the power of compounding in order to provide a better ratio of benefits to costs. And therefore, annual contributions by the employee and the employer both to an account should be invested wisely, and by the time that the employee reaches retirement, the amount should be sufficient to guarantee a good benefit. I think there's certainly general agreement on this. However, employers and employees are advocating different criteria. The key criteria from the employer coalition, and I just list the four important ones: cost to public employers must be predictable and affordable. Benefits to employees must also be predictable and sound. Employers and employees must share cost and market risk, and the plan must cover all employees, present and future. The key criteria for the employee unions are three: create a defined benefit plan, establish a 60% replacement ratio, and the successor plan must only cover new hires. It is clear, therefore, that the criteria of these two major groups are mostly incompatible or opposed to each other. As an employer and a taxpayer, of course, I support the criteria of the employer coalition, even though I recognize that no plan can be designed which can make both costs and benefits predictable. And therefore, there is a contradiction in the criteria of the employers, because we cannot have both. We have to choose which one of these two we have to have. Now, again, commonly used retirement plans are either defined benefit or defined contribution. And the essential difference is that a defined benefit plan sets a fixed amount, which is normally expressed as a replacement ratio compared to the final average salaries of the employees. And so it fixed that benefit at a fixed level, and there's no argument. However, the cost, that is the annual contributions which are required to support or fund that benefit, depend very sensitively on the investment return, on the return on investment in the members' and employers' accounts. And therefore, because we do not know what the investment return is going to be over a variable period of time, then we do not know what contributions will be required to fund the system, and therefore there is no way in the defined benefit system the benefit is predictable, but the cost is not. Okay, of course, in a defined contribution system, it's just the reverse. Then the cost is defined, and we know what that cost is going to be, but because the amount that will be available in the account, to provide benefits, is going to depend on stock market or investment returns over a number of years, then we have no idea what that benefit is going to be. And therefore, you have that dilemma. You have these two kinds of plans, and one guarantees the cost but leaves the benefit uncertain. The other one defined guarantees the benefit, then leaves the cost uncertain. And I have, if you look at the last page of this, I've given an illustration of what would happen, again, to illustrate the fact that the required contribution rate depends sensitively on the assumed or on the long-term average investment return. And so what I've shown in here, I've taken the case of defined benefit plans and I've looked at two possibilities. You have an employee who is retiring after 36 years of credited service and is entitled to a defined benefit of 60% replacement ratio. The other one that I considered is 30 years of credited service and 50% replacement ratio. And what I've shown in here is that if you assume that you're going to have an average investment return of 6%, then for the 60% replacement ratio after 36 years, the total annual contribution would have to be 11% of salaries. And that could be entirely from the employer or from the share by the employer and the employee. Okay. On the other hand, if your investment return only averages 4%, then the annual contribution has to be 16% of the salary instead of 11%. On the other hand, if you have a better investment return, like 8% average, then 7.5% of salary would be a sufficient contribution. So you can see from this that, again, there is a great uncertainty, and this is, of course, one of the main concerns that the employers would have with a defined benefit system, is that they had no idea what contribution rates and are going to be required, because they have no idea what long-term investment returns are going to be. And therefore, this is, therefore, I would feel as an employer, and I think other employers would feel the same way, that the only way that a defined benefit system could be considered or meet approval of the employers would be if there was a definite agreement that the employees as well as the employers would share the costs, uncertainties, and the market risks associated with a definite benefit plan, which is not the case in the present. We do have in the current first system, as of 1981 legislature, a full formula defined benefit plan, but this one says that the employee is entirely sheltered or shielded from any cost uncertainty or market risk, because the employer is the one who is solely responsible for adjusting his contribution in order to make good on the promised benefit. Okay, so then we have a dilemma here, because the employees are going to very much want to have a defined benefit system. I don't know that they're prepared to say that the employee contribution will have to be adjusted to respond to market conditions. On the other hand, the employers will want, or would certainly much prefer, a defined contribution system, and would consider a defined benefit only if, again, the employees as well as the employer can be made accountable for any adjustment in contributions which might be required to meet that benefit. And then it occurred to me, and this is what I want to conclude with, that perhaps there is a way or a compromise or a solution which might actually reconcile those two positions. And this is what I want to then to suggest as a final thing. And that is that perhaps a solution which might be acceptable to both would be to offer employees, I mean the present employees, if the current system is terminated, and in the future employees, a combination of an employer-funded defined benefit system and an employee-funded defined contribution plan. For instance, the employer could set this contribution rate at 6% of salary. And so if you did this and you go through the calculation, then you conclude that this would provide a defined benefit of 30% replacement ratio, but this is just for the employer portion, after 36 years of credited service. But of course, because this is a defined benefit system, and the employer would have to be prepared, if the investment return, which is assumed here at 6%, if it turns out to be less than 6%, then the employer would have to be prepared to increase its contribution rate beyond the 6%, so that the defined benefit, which was promised by the employer, could be delivered at the promised level. Now, for the employee, of course, the employee could contribute, let's say, 6% of his salary to a defined contribution system, and then that would go over the years being invested, and then depending on the investment return, then that would provide him with a replacement ratio on his own account, defined contribution, which, if the long-term average investment return were 6%, he would get another 30%, so that together between the employer-defined benefit and the employer-defined contribution, he would have a 60% replacement ratio, which is what we'd like to have. On the other hand, if the investment return were good, you know, higher than the 6%, let's say 8% for instance, then he would get 45% replacement ratio on his account. If you add that to the 30% on the other one, that means now he would get a combined 75%. Therefore, I think that this concept, you know, of making two plans available, the defined benefit employer funded and the defined contribution employee funded, is one that is very flexible. The employer would be free, because it is his own contribution, to put in 6% or 4% or 10%, you know, whatever he wanted to do. If he wanted to enhance his retirement, he could just make a larger contribution. And because of the defined benefit portion of that compensation, then he would be assured of a reasonable minimum benefit, no matter what stock market conditions were. On the other hand, if the stock market conditions were good or investment returns high, then he might get, you know, as high as 90% or 100% replacement ratio, but that would be done, you know, by just the wise use of his funds, not by drawing additional contribution from the employee. So, you know, again, I've been waiting for Bill 2003 to come before you, because I think that is a very, very important bill, and I would hope to be able to come before you at that time again. In the meantime, though, I have these thoughts on successor plans, and I thought I would hope that you would consider them. I think, again, we have to find some way of reconciling those two positions, and maybe, again, some kind of a compromise like this with a combination of plans might be the most effective way to do that.
Thank you, Francis. I want to point you to the head of the work group right now, but I'm tempted to do that at this point if you're trying to bring both sides together. But I really appreciate you coming forward and bringing us this information, and I look forward to having you come back at a future date when we have House Bill 2003 and other issues before us about the new plan.
I would say I've been retired for a few years, and it's been a very good job.
Thank you.
Call on me, please.
Thank you. I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2008, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2004. And there he is, Dave Hendricks. You want to come up and take us through the dash 11s? We had a few little changes to the dash 10s, and I know you're excited to be working on a dash 11 on this, and we really do appreciate the time that you put in on this. I know it's been painstaking for you.
Chair Knope, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Yes, going from dash 6 to dash 11 tells you something right there. The amendments have gone through quite a few changes, although I will say that essentially what you see here is pretty much the set of amendments I described 2 days ago when you were looking at the dash 6 amendments. The basic principles that I talked about with respect to the dash 6 are still encompassed here. Hopefully it's a little clearer in some of the pieces about the calculations that are being required here and the effect of those calculations. The preamble was the dash 7 amendments, and I'm not going to spend time on that unless anybody has any particular question about the preamble. And that's, but I think I'll go straight to page 2 in section 2, which is the operative language and the permanent provision of law relating to implementation of new mortality tables. It has remained essentially the same as what was in the Dash 6 amendments. Once again, there will be no look back on subsequent changes to the mortality table. The board is directed to take a look at the mortality tables for purposes of the putting together the actuarial equivalency factor tables every 2 years, and the hope is that by keeping it up, we won't have the type of radical changes in benefits by reason of implementation of new mortality tables, with the board looking at them every 2 years. Section 3 remains the same. The first tables are going to be done on January 1st, 2005. And then Section 4, which is the look-back provision, is where you're going to see most of the changes between this and the Dash 6 amendments. Although, again, it is more a matter of style and clarity and specification than anything else. Subsection 1 of Section 4, which starts at line 13 on page 3, is essentially a provision that directs the board to use actuarial equivalency factor tables using the mortality assumptions adopted last year by the board for any person who retires on or after July 1st, 2003 and before January 1st, 2005. So that is the implementation. It's still July 1st, 2003, as discussed with the Dash 6 amendments. And the thought is subsection 1 is that there will be no board action required for this. The idea is that they will use them. It's a mechanical thing, an administrative thing at that point. If they use the mortality assumptions adopted on September 10, 2002 to put together the mortality tables. It is not at that point it doesn't require board action to adopt them. So they will automatically be in effect on July 1st, 2003 for anybody who retires on or after that date. That approach allowed us to simplify what is now subsection 2 that starts on line 20 and goes down. Because we're down to, unlike the DAS 6, we're down to two calculations now, and it makes it hopefully a little clearer. The two calculations are, what would you get on your date of retirement under the mortality tables in effect at that time? And if under subsection 1, if it's July, if you're after July 1st, it's going to be underneath those mortality tables. If it's after 2005, it might be under different mortality tables, but you're going to look at whatever the mortality tables are at that date, and you just do a standard computation of the benefit, and you arrive at your monthly date amount. And it's an amount calculated under the basic computation for the service retirement allowance. That's in 238 ORS 238-300. So that's the calculation we're looking at. The second amount you're going to look at is an amount calculated under subsection 3. That's the look back. That's the one where you're going to go back and look at certain things on June 30th, 2003. You're going to look at what the old mortality tables look like, what they were at that time, and you're going to look at the account balance that's going to be established for you at that time by the board, looking at the contributions made through June 30th, looking at earnings credited to the account through June 30th, and then based on those factors, the board's going to go ahead and do a calculation of the benefit to try to, as much as possible, preserve the benefit. I should say, I want to make one thing kind of clear, and I think this was it. This was in the DAS 6 amendments, although it may not be terribly clear, because this is terribly complicated. The impact that's going to happen here is going to be in the calculation of the basic benefit. And the basic benefit in PERS is a fairly complicated thing even to describe, but in essence we're saying we're looking at your account balance and we're going to figure out, in converting that over into an annuity, when you do that for purposes of calculating the basic benefit, that's where that's where life expectancy comes into play. Because whenever you're talking about doing an annuity, by definition, you're saying payments for life, and you have to know what the anticipated life is. So you're going to get to a basic calculation that preserves, to the extent possible, the status quo on June 30th, 2003, and say, well, you're going to get at least that much on the basic computation. Other things then can happen for the member. Members are allowed to make various conversions of that basic benefit. They can pick one of the optional plans that says, I want it to the benefit to last for my life and the life of my spouse or of a beneficiary that I designate. When you say that, other lives come into play, and once again you have the question of the actuarial equivalency tables. You've taken care of most of the impact in computing the basic benefit, but there are other impacts from those conversions. The look-back doesn't apply to those impacts. It doesn't. You still have some impact there. I'm not an actuary. I can't tell you how much. I've been told that most of the impact's taken out by making the change to the basic calculation, but there is additional impact there. So depending on the choices you make when you retire about options, etc., you shouldn't be led to think that the effect of these amendments is that you're always going to get exactly what you would have gotten on June 30th, 2003 if you retired, because that is not the case. Depending on what options you take, you may in fact still have some impact. But it does get incredibly difficult to start looking at how to preserve that situation so that any option that you pick, you're going to get at least as much as you got on June 30th, 2003. And because, the other thing I would say is because of the emphasis on the account balance, there are a certain number of people in the system who will go out underneath the defined benefit portion of PERS, the full formula, what's normally called the full formula calculation. There have been some changes that appear in the language here that links the calculation here to the annuity portion of the calculation. It's not clear. For most of those people, probably the look-back's not going to make much difference. I think that's probably a fair estimate. That for those people that this, because they're not based on the account balance, because of the choices that were made about how to structure this, that to the extent that their benefit, when they make their conversions, for instance, because they're a defined benefit, you know, the account balance doesn't make much difference. I mean, the account balance feeds into getting at who's responsible for paying for the benefit, but their benefit is defined by how many years did you work, what was your final salary, and a factor that they use, 1.67 or 2%. It's a fixed amount, and that basic benefit, to a large degree, has nothing to do whatsoever with how long you live. That's what you get for life. It's when you do the first conversion out of there that the impact comes in. The amendments as they're now structured, that conversion there will still be influenced by the actuarial tables, and because there is an look back, they may have some drop in the benefit as well. So I want to make, I guess what I'm emphasizing is that I don't want to leave the impression that by reason of doing this, every single member, when they retire, no matter what option they pick, they don't have to worry they're going to get exactly the amount they would have gotten on June 30th, 2003, because it's very difficult to structure it that way, and that's not the way the amendments are structured. The only thing I'll mention on Section 5, one other thing on Section 4, judge members, which is something that was discussed a bit at the last meeting. The amendments now, the Section 4 now says nothing about judge members. Judge members, as I mentioned at the last meeting, have a very have a pure defined benefit for their basic calculation. It's purely years of service times final average service times a factor. It's a higher factor than applies to even police officers. It's a fairly high factor for the first 16 years of service. For those members, it doesn't make any difference if they're just taking the basic benefit. And it doesn't make any difference if they have a spouse and the spouse has a benefit as well, because the spouse's benefit is two-thirds of what the judge gets. So actuarial factor tables just don't come into play for those basic benefits for the judge and for the spouse of the judge. The one place it might come into play, again, is a conversion that's available to them, where the judge can say, well, that's all fine and good, but I'd really like to have my spouse get the same amount as I get during my lifetime. And they have that option to do that, to bump up the two-thirds that the spouse rather would get to a higher amount, lowering the amount payable to the judge during the judge's lifetime, and actuarial tables come into play there. There's no look back for that piece, just as there's no look back for the conversion or regular PERS members after their basic calculation is made, and there's no look back for most defined benefit that retirees as well. I'm just going to mention quickly on Section 5 is the expedited review provision for the Supreme Court, and the only change that's been made in that from what was the Dash 2 amendments that were handed out is there was concern about requiring that the petition for review being filed within 60 days after the effective date of the Act, because there was questions about whether anybody would be harmed within that period and have standing. The draft now says that you can file a petition for review before January 1st, 2004. So the window is longer for expedited review.
Dave, is that... that almost seems too long. Can you explain the process, and could it be a shorter time frame? I just want to make sure we're not delaying it getting to the court in a more timely manner.
Yeah, it depends. As soon as one person retires after July 1st, it seems pretty clear they have standing at that point. There's an argument to be made that you have standing when the bill is passed if you're contemplating retiring at that point. But, you know, you have to leave some window to where, if that was the concern that was expressed, you have to leave some window after the bill becomes effective to allow someone to go in. September 1st might work just as well.
Are there any rules that the PERS Board has to adopt that they would have a process that they would have to go through that could run over not the time frame that we had, but the former time frame, or lack thereof, the 60-day?
Chair Knope, is there some way that it could be delayed to the point where...
That the PERS Board... I mean, are we instructing the PERS Board to promulgate any rules here that they would have to go through a process in any way that, you know, with notice and with hearings and those types of things that would run us through the former 60-day period?
Chair Knope, as I mentioned on Section 4, Sub 1, that is designed to be self-executing, to not require board action, because there was concern about that. As a practical matter, even if that was a concern, the board is in a position right now to adopt tables because they were planning on doing that next week.
They have adopted the tables. They just haven't adopted. Well, they've adopted the actuarial equivalency
assumptions.
Yeah. But they haven't actually applied them to the benefits.
Correct. But I think, as I said about Section 4 Sub 1, that this should be a purely administrative function at this point. That further board action would not be necessary to adopt tables. And I'd be happy to try to answer any other questions on a fairly complicated subject.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Dave, thank you for that explanation. Let me just make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying about the look back. I think what I'm hearing is that we should draw a distinction between the establishment of what I would call a basic benefit, that is, it's a life annuity benefit, that is, for the life of the member, and conversions from that form then to alternative annuity forms that are, say, a joint and survivor annuity with a spouse or some other form of annuity benefit. And I think what you're saying is that the look back would apply to the process of establishing what that baseline or basic retirement benefit is, and it would not apply to the variations than to alternative benefit forms at the election of the member. Is that correct?
That Representative Canope, Representative McPherson, that is correct. And what that means is for those members to whom the account balance makes no difference to the calculation of their basic benefit, then there is no look back for those, simply because that, you know, the way it's structured, it's the account balance conversion to the annuity where the look back is being applied. So for a judge member, for instance, where there is no account balance conversion to an annuity, there is simply a monthly amount for life that's generated by looking at length of service, final average salary, and the factor, the standard defined benefit type plan that you've been looking at in 2008. For those people, this doesn't, they don't have those issues now because of the way their benefit is computed. The only time they look at the issue is when they do the conversion to an alternative type of benefit, which involves the life of another person.
Right. Would it also be fair to say that the variations in that second piece, that is to conversions to alternative benefit forms, would be relatively more modest than the impacts of converting from the account to an annuity benefit? That it might go either way, that is, it could go up or down in favor of the member or against the member, to use a more modern mortality table, and that it would be driven by the choice exercised by the member. Are all those true statements?
Chair Canoe, Representative McPherson, I believe they're true, and this because to some degree on some of these things, because what I've been told, I, you know, some of these things you, without the education as an actuary, you have to take it based on what people have told you. I've been told that to be, that is the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question relative to the choices that an employee may make at the time of retirement. I am concerned about the obligation on the part of the PERS to make those various calculations and the rapidity with which those calculations have to be made. And there are a lot of choices that have to be selected at that time. Is it their obligation to go and check each one of those calculations or just those that might be available? What's the obligation at that point?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, I believe that their administrative practice is, for purposes of doing the basic calculation, my understanding is for many people they have guidelines that tell them instantly they don't have to do, you know, the full formula and the money match, because there are guidelines they have that tell them pretty much, pretty quickly, which category people are going to. So there's not much calculation going on there. On the conversion, it depends, I think, on what people ask them. If people say, I'm interested in doing this, and you tell me what it is, that's when they run those. I don't think they run, they can, they're here, the persons are here and can tell you, I don't think they run, there are like 9 different options now for the conversion for the standard after we get the double lump sum in. Some of them are easier than others, obviously. A double lump sum is an easy one to compute, twice your account balance. So I think they do it based on what they're asked.
Mr. Chair, I think that's what's perplexing to me is that if a retiring participant doesn't ask for or doesn't know which to ask for, because these are complex issues, then what happens is that retiring employee who doesn't ask for the full array may overlook some other possibility depending upon their domestic situation and some of their other issues within their own portfolio and lifestyle and so forth. And I just would like to have some level of comfort to make absolutely certain that we're not placing more burden upon the agency to make calculations that they don't already make based upon that basic amount.
Well, Mr. Comfort here, I think, can help you.
Okay.
Steve, can you...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, Purge Legislative Liaison. Each member does receive an estimate in preparation for retirement that lists out all of the options already for them. The system is built to provide those. Obviously, we are going to have to look at our system and look back piece, but as far as all the options currently, they see them all so they can choose what is best for them.
I stand corrected.
Thank you. Other questions of... Dave?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, can you help me understand in the Dash 11 amendments the preamble language, what legal effect it has? Does it change policy? Does it direct anything? And in particular, I'm interested in lines 15, 16, and 17 on page 1 of the Dash 11 amendment. Does that change policy?
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, to your first question, the preamble falls in the category of legislative history, things that a court might look to in trying to determine the meaning behind the bill. The courts in the last 10 or 15 years have established a more rigid set of rules with respect to when they look to legislative history. And I think it's probably fair to say they look to it a little less now than they have perhaps in years past. And the rule has always been that they're not supposed to look to legislative history unless the law in front of them is ambiguous. That was the old rule. Now they've said that they've kind of turned that around a little bit, and they said we'll only look to such things if we can't figure out the meaning of the law from the text and context of the law. It's another way of saying, you know, if it's ambiguous or we can't make out. We always hope that when we draft these bills that they're clear enough that the court never would have to resort to legislative history. But beyond that, that's about the extent of what a preamble does. It basically will be there in the event there's ambiguities within the text of the statute. I would not anticipate that a court would look to it. Well, that's what they look to legislative history for, and that's what this is. So, and as far as language at lines 15 through 17, that is language that actually comes out of the amendments that were made to the board's duties by Senate Bill 134 last session. I think it pretty much paraphrases what that says, that the board is charged with giving equal consideration to the interests of the public employee to the extent consistent with the board's fiduciary duties. Since the board's fiduciary duties are primarily to the employees, we had many discussions on 134 as to when this might come into play, but there were discussions of some possible scenarios where in fact there might be some scenarios where in fact consistent with that duty, primary duty to the employee, that you would exercise the board's discretion for the interest of both employer and employee.
Representative Nolan, can I just ask one question that might get to this point? Does the preamble portion of this become statute?
It does not.
Okay.
It does not. It is not printed in the ORS. It is not codified. It is not a law.
Does that get to where you were wanting to answer?
It's pretty close. I was wanting to clarify that it wasn't an attempt here to trump the fiduciary duties of the board. Another follow-up, Mr. Chair, on a different subject. Just as I'm trying to sort through how the board would apply this new direction, and in particular the notion of freezing an employee's account at June 30th, is it clear to you, and maybe this question needs to go to the board members, but I want to make sure that it's clear in the way you've written this, how that, as we freeze an account, say we have an employee who's 60 years old on June 30th, doesn't really want to retire, this bill takes away an incentive to retire or doesn't push them to the door, as we've talked about. Their account gets frozen at age 60 with the current mortality table. Say they decide to retire a year later. Do those mortality tables apply to their current account at age 60 or at age 61?
Chair Knope, Representative Nolan, I should tell you, saying that the account is frozen may lead to misapprehensions as to what the bill does. Your account isn't frozen. Your account continues to grow. And if you're Tier 1, you continue to get the 8% guaranteed earnings to it, and you continue to make contributions as long as you continue to work. When we talk about, I know you like to say frozen, it's when the person does retire, what the board is directed to do is go back and say, let's create this fictional account as it existed, as it would have been. Let's try to find out exactly what was in the account as of June 30th, 2003. And they will look at how much was credited and how much was earned. They're going to have to do something they normally don't do. They're going to have to come up with some figure to credit for all the accounts on June 30th to find out how much were in the account on that date. And then a separate calculation is made based on that account balance and based on the older mortality table. So the account isn't frozen. What happens, though, is that because the mortality tables would otherwise cause a drop in the amount that's being paid, that because you have that look back to what it would have been if you'd retired back in June 30, 2003 with that account balance, if that calculation puts you higher than what you get under the new mortality tables with whatever your account balance is when you retire, you will get the higher amount. At a certain point, your account will go to the point where you will have enough in there in your account under the new mortality tables that calculation based on what on the situation in June 30th, 2003 becomes irrelevant. And as we've mentioned, that could be, for some people, a matter of months. It may be as much as, it's hard to tell. Those I haven't seen any new charts and figures on under this proposal. Certainly it isn't a matter probably of many years for anybody, but it could be years. I don't think we're talking. But during that period of time, basically, your monthly benefit is protected. And as I said, not necessarily everybody 100%, but protected to some degree by the look back. And so that's the significance. It's not so much your account's frozen, it's there's an amount account established for purposes of the calculation.
So to make sure I understood the answer, Mr. Chair, if I'm this retiree and I'm 60 on June 30th, 03, is the amount that's fixed the monthly benefit that I would get at age 60 with the account balance, or if I retire a year later, is it the monthly benefit I would get at age 61 with that account balance?
Yes.
Because they're different. I have less to live, and my monthly benefit would be larger.
Your monthly benefit?
At age 61 than at age 60.
Correct. If they're... Okay. Let's see how we can answer this.
Steve?
Peter.
We're going to go to the top here.
Does the birdie come down to the sky? Did I ask the right question?
I need the birdie.
Or did Chair Canope, thought through this one yet?
No, Representative Nolan. No, we have. And we understand that Dash 11 would operate in the same way that the board's proposal would that is currently pending, and that is we would use the age at retirement, the older age. Think of it this way, if I could. A person comes to us several years down the road after 7103 and wants to retire. All of the circumstances we use to calculate their retirement, we would do. Their age at retirement, their actual balance, which, as David said, is not frozen but continues to grow, and we would calculate a benefit under the option that they chose. Then we would, including in that calculation, we would calculate this first benefit. That is, and the first benefit is the same. The core benefit, or the base benefit, we call it, is the same in all forms of calculations. Money match, four formula, and pension plus annuity. Then we would do the look back that you have, that you are about to instruct us to do if this legislation is approved. We would reach back and pull forward two things. One is the account balance that is, quote, frozen and set aside as a marker. It's a value. And we would plug it in, but we would plug it in not with the new modern tables, but we would plug it into this calculation with the old tables. And we would see if it produces a core benefit that would then feed into these options, which are a matter of member choice. And we would see if that core benefit is higher, then we would use the old benefit, the old set aside frozen value of 6303 and the old factors. However, if the core benefit had grown because of additional growth in the account, additional contributions, then we'd say, forget, and we would retire them at their retirement age under the new factors, because that would produce the highest initial base benefit.
Okay. Thanks.
That was much clearer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Is Mr. Boyko going to come back up?
We sure can have him come back up.
I do have a question for him whenever you wish to.
Jim, you might as well do it now. Thanks, Dave. You might want to stand by. We never know when we'll need legal help.
Well, funny you should mention legal help, because that's...
Oh, is that your question?
Why I wanted to talk to Mr. Boyko about. And I understand you're in a bit of a situation here because you're acting under the direction of your board, but I have become aware that there's been legal advice given to your board relating to the method and timing of implementing a change in mortality tables. And I understand that some members of our committee have it, and yet it's not in our public record. And I'm struggling in making a decision on whether to support this legislation, knowing that there's significant information out there that I don't have access to. Can you address where the board is on the question of revealing that information?
Chair Cano, Representative Nolan, I'll tell you as much as I can without breaking a privilege that is not mine to break. The board, when it began analyzing this question, confronted the same claims, highly disparate claims, by the way, which you have heard in testimony before this committee, relating to contract rights, for example. One camp believes in what I call the hard version of contract rights, which is basically everything in the statute, every word conveys a right, and that right is historical in nature and accrues over time. I think Mr. Hartman said it well as an example that when a member joins PERS, on his lapel, I believe is the way he phrased it, is the mortality tables, for example, of that era, and that they carry them through in time, if I recall correctly. You heard from Mr. Gary a quite different point of view of contract rights, that surely there are some promises in the statute, but there are 64,000 words worth, and they have to be balanced off against one another, including, for example, he argued, the requirement throughout the statute that things be actuarially equivalent. The board, understanding that this was an issue, wanted to make sure that it understood the various options, ramifications, possibilities of how the courts might look at this general issue, and did consult with their attorneys and on this issue and other related ones, and came forward with a proposal out of that deliberation, most of which, the vast majority of which, was public, and you've seen the record. But it is true that the legal consultations were held in executive session and produced a look-back mechanism, not dissimilar in function and purpose than the one that you have before you in HB 2004-11, but not precisely identical to that either. And that is where we stand today. Is that responsive to your question?
Well, it is responsive, but if I might, Mr. Chair.
You might.
Thank you. You referenced the aspect relating to contract rights, and you also said there's other issues in the legal opinions that have been presented that may also be germane to the policy decision before us today.
Chair Canop, Representative Vaughn, yes, there are two other issues, one of which was brought up in Judge Lipscomb's courtroom, and that was the applicability of IRS requirements or non-applicability, as the case might be, to public plans, an ERISA requirement. And there are various and sundry opinions about that subject as well. But that's... I think if I understood the testimony of others, that the contract rights one seems to be the dominant point of contention. And I believe, if I'm correct, that even Mr. Hartman, in a letter to the board, said essentially that the contract rights issue is overarching over the others, and that's why I mention it most specifically. In fact, if I may, I think he argues that that the IRS requirement does not apply and was specifically not supposed to apply because the United States Congress felt that state constitutional contract rights provisions were so sweeping and stood in their place.
I might just explain. It is not my purpose to put you in bind. I completely understand that you have obligations to your board, but knowing that some of my colleagues have access to this information and that it hasn't yet entered our public record, I'm concerned about making a policy decision of this magnitude absent that as part of our record.
Chair Canop, may I address that question as well?
You may.
From time to time, stretching over the past 9 or so months, legislators have expressed an interest in this, as well as employers, as well as plaintiffs on the other side of the table in litigation from the board and its legal representatives. The board has decided that it would not, and in fact, I believe at least 4 times has voted not to share the litigation analyses because they are views about what the court might or might not decide with respect to these questions with outside parties, particularly those that they are facing litigation or threatened litigation with. With respect to members of the government, i.e. legislators, that was a more difficult call because it is the policy of our board and of our staff to be absolutely open with every member of the legislature whenever they ask a question. So when asked this question, we went to the Justice Department and asked how could we, in essence, be as honest and open with members of the legislature inquiring about this, but at the same time, not break privilege and endanger the litigation, as well as endanger what I think is clear, which is a desire on the part of the legislature, as expressed in the expedited statute that's already been approved, to move the board's rule onto the Supreme Court, to give the Supreme Court an opportunity to instruct us all about what they mean. About what's the scope of contract rights, how are they conveyed, who has them, how long do they last, all the various and sundry questions that are bedeviling us in our statute. And I don't know what all the motivations of the board were, but one of them may be to let the court make a sort of tabula rasa decision on a policy as opposed to a policy plus all the things that we thought they might do or might not do with that policy. I don't really know. But in any case, and I'm sorry for going on, but this is important since you asked the question. The Justice Department devised first a policy of saying that we could protect and argue against the breaking of privilege by talking directly counsel to counsel, that is, the board's counsel to the legislature's counsel. And that was done. And the second, subsequently, the Justice Department, after some additional requests, decided that they could defend that the privilege was not broken, provided that the information was shared, but only with plan sponsors, if in essence, government to government, because in many respects, in fact, I think in fact, the legislator and the members of the assembly are the plan sponsors for the pension plan. You are the ultimate deciders. So that's where we stand today.
Thank you.
Just a note for the record, the chair has never been in possession of the Department of Justice's legal opinions on this issue. So just to make that clear. Anyone else? Jim, have you seen the fiscal that's been provided for the Dash 10s?
Yes, I have, Chair.
We now have Dash 11s, but materially they don't appear to be too much different than the Dash 10s. And since we're not going to have a fiscal, and I'd actually like to bring this to a vote today, would you anticipate any material change from these numbers that we've been given by fiscal?
Are we talking about the fiscal analysis of the administrative costs? Or are we talking about the actuarial analysis done by...
The actuarial analysis.
The actuarial analysis. Two comments on that. I estimated at the last meeting that, at the last time the committee met, that Mark Johnson's number would come out a little bit above $1.4 billion when the Dash 10s were put in place. And in fact, it came out to be about $1.5 and change. So I think we've got the direction right. I did have a fax exchange with Mark about the Dash 11s and asked him to alert us immediately if he thought that what he saw in the Dash 11s, which we sketched out for him both schematically as well as in the statutory language, and my staff discussed it with him to tell us whether he thought there were any material changes that needed to be made or that were likely up or down in the fiscal that he gave you for the actuarial impact for the Dash 10s, and he has not indicated that there is a material one. I think it's fair to Mark to say we haven't given him a lot of time, but I see no, at least looking at it from my point of view, I see no major changes in the effect of the look back financially the way David has constructed it now in the Dash 11s from a financial point of view than we saw in the Dash 10s. But I assure you I will close with Mark on that, but I'm not anticipating that it'll be significantly different than what you see for the Dash 10s, what Mark just provided to you.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks, Jim. Yeah, colleagues, clearly you can see on the fiscal, if you've got in front of you, for the 0305 biennium and certainly 0507, state agencies all funds $76 million savings on future costs, community colleges $12 million, local employers $85 million, roughly $85.6 million, school districts $110 million for a total of about $283.8 million. In future cost savings as it relates to this measure. And I believe on page 2, second paragraph, it indicates that the look-back provision would reduce the plan's unfunded liability, you know, after July 1st. No,
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
It says in here the actuary, it's in that second, basically that second sentence, that the unfunded liability would be reduced by appears to be $1.59 billion. So I wanted to highlight that for committee members just because we had discussed the different options as it relates to this and where this lies in terms of future cost savings. I believe there is likely to be a comment. I think I'll have Bill Linden come up first because I hope his comment is the shortest. He might want to put something on the record as it relates to judges. And we believe...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Linden, representing the Circuit Court Judges Association and the Appellate Court Judges Association. I've only had an opportunity to briefly review the Dash 11s, but The question I want to raise, and I'm more than willing to have counsel or any member of the committee or, for that matter, any member of the audience tell me I'm worrying about something I don't need to, but right now, judges, by and large, would not be affected because most of our judges retire with a defined benefit. Their plan is very much different than regular PERS. In current law, however, there is one opportunity for judges to elect a particular conversion that essentially provides that they take a reduced benefit on retirement so that their surviving spouse receives the same benefit amount that the judge would receive while he or she was alive. And that if they elect that conversion, then actuarial tables are applied in computing what their benefit's going to be. And I'm assuming under the Dash 11s that their benefit would be reduced. If I'm making the wrong assumption, please so indicate. But if in fact the
we
benefit
think you're wrong, but hey, what the we appreciate fact, you putting it on the record.
If in fact their benefits would be reduced, then of course we would object to these amendments being applied to judges who retire under their PERS statute.
Okay, Dave, can you enlighten us in any way on this particular issue? Because I know we've sort of been round and round on this, and we tried to remove judges in the Dash 11s, I guess.
Chair Knope, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks again. For that one conversion option, and it's not necessarily always 100%, it's a little vaguer than that. That's one of the possibilities under it. For those types of conversions, the look back does not apply. So with that,
Mr. Chair, if I could maybe pursue a point, or which maybe I turn into a question here to respond to this point. The change to more modern mortality tables would apply to judges in common with all other members. And that change would affect the amount payable under alternative benefit forms. It could be higher or could be lower in benefit result, depending on what the gender and age are of the judge and the spouse, so that there wouldn't be any reason to think necessarily that it would be a negative impact as opposed to a positive impact. It would be an impact, and that impact would be the same as would apply to conversions going on for non-judge members when they convert to alternative benefit forms. And I put that in a question to Dave Hendricks.
Representative Knope, Representative McPherson, it's hard to figure out because there are so many different scenarios that can come up that, and I haven't really thought through. It'd be nice to have some examples on this to be able to give you, but depending on the difference in the age between the judge and the spouse, it could make a lot of difference as far as whether or not the updated tables is a harm or a benefit to them. I believe that's correct. I suspect Representative McPherson can explain this better than I. I mean, I haven't really thought it through as far as the different scenarios, but if you had a very young spouse, for instance, when the conversion was made, and an older judge, I'm just trying to think of how that plays out under mortality tables with longer lifespan. Does it necessarily always come up with a lower benefit with the new mortality tables? I haven't thought them all through. It's pretty hard. It's a difficult, complicated area. But certainly, if mortality tables go down, then in those cases, it seems to me that that in fact there could be some benefit on it, and that is a possibility.
Mr. Chair, if I could make a comment, which is that I think we probably have gone beyond the actuarial expertise that Dave Hendricks has. I have, but it is not the intention here to have any net negative impact on judges. The intention is to be neutral in the impact, and I sincerely believe, to the extent of my actuarial knowledge, that is the impact. Now, would be open to persuasion by somebody who has greater expertise than I have. But I believe that it is only in the conversions to alternative forms that this would come into play for judges, and that those impacts could go either way. And I see Jim Voitko, who probably has this about the same level of actuarial expertise as we have, nodding his head. That may be as good as we're going to be able to gather in terms of expertise in this gathering today. But it is certainly not the intention here to have any disadvantageous impact on judges.
No, as a matter of fact, we see 2004 as very judge-friendly.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just pose one quick question to Representative McPherson. So it would be accurate for me to describe this to the judges who are interested, that this is not intended to have any... It's intended to be neutral in terms of their benefit levels, and it may, however, have a slight positive or a slight negative impact given whatever the particular judge and that judge's spouse's situation, age, etc. were.
Right. That's right. Given the particular circumstances of a judge and spouse and what the age difference is between them, it may be that the impact would be for a particular judge positive, that is, of going to a more modern mortality table, positive, or for another judge, negative. But the net impact, I believe, is neutral, and it's certainly the intention to be entirely neutral, or, as the chair suggested, very judge-friendly.
That's an adequate record for me.
Thanks, Bill. Brian Glashman.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLashment. I represent a number of clients that I've explained to you in the past, but I am up here on behalf of the First Coalition along with Bill asking to stay to talk about one particular section of the expedited process. But let me explain to you kind of the sense of where I feel I'm at today. I was a pretty good student going through high school and through college, and I was also very good at test-taking, but I feel like I'm in the middle of a pop quiz here in which I've been given... been preparing for a particular test on a dash 10, and now there's been a slight change, although some of them technical, but the one change that I will bring to your attention that I'm trying to respond to and I'm actually trying to understand is the dynamic of the change in Section 4 as it impacts more than just people that are going out in the money match. You've been hearing had a lot of dialogue about impact or not impact on judges, and the real answer, as I understand it, is it doesn't have any more or less impact on judges than anyone else, but it does have an impact on judges the way it's written. I also am now understanding that because of the way Section 4 was rewritten, that a police officer or a firefighter who was going out under the full formula, this bill as written now does in fact have a potential for an impact on their benefit. When we were dealing with dash 10s, it's my understanding that, in fact, the only calculations in which it would have an impact on a police officer or a firefighter or anybody in PNF was when it was applied only to the money match, that a police officer or a firefighter was going out on a basic, simple calculation of years of service times the multiplication factor times the final average salary. And it's my understanding conversations with the first staff prior to this hearing and then hearing the testimony now that, in fact, they have now realized that it, in fact, does have impact the way Dash 11 is written that they had not envisioned. So, one, that concerns me, that all of a sudden we've got a new element that we maybe haven't all the way thought through. I guess the second comment I would have, and I do understand Representative McPherson's theoretical issue about benefits could go up or go down, but I cannot imagine under a new table when you add 4 or 5 years of additional life expectancy in which a new table would generate a higher benefit or an advantage to somebody in the future by using the new table. So I can't, without seeing an example of that, I can't imagine that. So let me just go through a couple of comments on behalf of the First Coalition that we've talked about. Some of these have changed slightly going from the dash 10 to the dash 11, so I've tried to kind of modify my comments. Some of them are still applicable to the 10s and the 11s. Some have changed slightly. The first one is, in reading the dash 10s, there was concern amongst the First Coalition that the way the language is structured in the dash 10s, and it may be clarified, and I would like to have Dave on the record clarify the answer that he gave me, and you can call him up in a minute, that in fact subsequent changes to actuarial tables, if they were done in 2005 or 2007, if somebody had not graduated all the way on this flat book back, graduated all the way to the newer table, the changed table, before we implemented new tables, that in fact any look back going back to the initial change was not wiped out. So in essence, there in fact still is a base that was the initial calculation, and they can't get lower than that. You understand? Hopefully everybody's understanding the question that I'm posing, because it was unclear in the initial reading of that that there could be a possibility that if it took several years for somebody to graduate from the old table, the current table, to the first new table, and there was another new table that was put in place and there was no look back, that in fact they would get wiped out all the way back of the initial look back. So I guess I would pose that question and a concern I'd like to have on the record, but that's not the intent for the language contained in the bill. You can do that at some point. I'll go through the rest of my questions. The First Coalition would like to also place on the record that we are opposed, no surprise, to the base policy of a flat look back. It in fact does put, despite what you've heard in the questions that Representative Nolan was posing, it does in fact put not the account balance in limbo from earning the assumed rate, but it does in fact put the benefit and any accrual of an assumed rate in limbo during that period of transition. And so no one need be, I guess, blind to the reality that there's a difference in the way you pose it. The account balance is not frozen, but the benefit is frozen. And if the benefit's frozen and there's no additional accrual of interest or the assumed rate on that, the net impact is that, in fact, there is no assumed rate or 8% being added to those account balances. We believe that's a flaw in the bill that's coming in front of you now. We believe that the PERS board made the correct decision, and that is, as Mr. Voitko had explained, the slight deviation or modification between your plan and the plan that the PERS board had adopted or planned to adopt later this month. We think that's not a slight difference. We think that's a major modification. And we do not agree with that as the base philosophy of this. The next thing that I'd like to respond to, and it really is directly related to Representative Nolan's question, I don't think she ever really got a direct answer. Hopefully you understood what was being said. I understood what Mr. Boyko and Mr. Hendricks were saying. But my understanding in the scenario that you raised is that the core benefit of that 60-year-old at June 10th is locked in, and then if they decide to go out a year later, that core benefit is still calculated at 60 years old on June 10th, but the new calculation that they're matching that up against is the new table with the additional accrual of benefits or of assets into the account at the age 61, and that then you see which generates the higher benefit. My understanding is you don't go back and say, okay, here's the core benefit on June 30th of 2003 at age 60, and then when you finally do the look back, you say, oh, okay, this person's now 61, so the core benefit that was calculated June 30th of 2003 is now being calculated on that person at 61 years of age. Because in essence, why are you having a look back then? You in fact have not abandoned the old tables. So if my understanding of that is incorrect, I think somebody needs to correct that. You are matching a calculation based upon an old table and the age at the time in which that core benefit is established versus a calculation on a new table at the age in which somebody actually retires and seeing which benefit is the higher.
Mr. Chair, that is not what I heard, so it would be worth clarifying at some point. That's not the way I understood it. Maybe what I heard, but I didn't understand it.
I never heard a direct answer, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, to your question about what are they calculating on the look back, age 60 or 61. I would be surprised if it's when they look back, because they're doing the initial core benefit calculation
at that point, at the age, as if you were going to retire at that point. The last thing that I'll let Bill talk about is the expedited process that's in it. Although it's modified slightly from the Dash 10 to the Dash 11, we do have a couple of concerns about the expedited process, and you know, I'll let Bill touch on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Linden again. In this piece of legislation, you've set up an expedited appeal to the Supreme Court. There's at least one other bill that's already been acted on in the House Judiciary Committee that sets up a separate path of expedited appeal on PERS-related issues that dealt with the circuit court case here in Marion County. You may have other PERS-related bills that are also going to have some need for an expedited appeal. My suggestion is that you delete Section 5. At some point in this process, be it in the Senate or in conference committee, you can, instead of creating separate paths of expedited appeal for different issues related to PERS, bring them all together at some point, again, later in this process, and set up one path. Now, our original concern with the Dash 10 amendments was that it appeared to set some timelines that were unrealistic in terms of actually pursuing an appeal. By moving the date back to January 1, 2004, those may well have been addressed. But in any event, I would recommend you look at the option of one single path of appeal for all of these PERS-related issues that you're dealing with and going to be dealing with in this session.
Mr. Chair, if I may add one additional thing that our counsel on the expedited process had asked us to bring up is what he considers a difference or substantial difference between an expedited process in which there is a trial court level, in this case it would be the circuit court, and then an expedited process to the Supreme Court versus a directly expedited process from the legislature to the Supreme Court, and how that would be handled. I would make the assumption, obviously, that if that were to occur, that the court then, the Supreme Court, would establish a master to collect the information. There would be some kind of a hearing record made at that point in order for the Supreme Court to make a judgment on that record. There is some concern that by doing it that way, there is not a full and adequate airing of the issue at the trial level for the Supreme Court to actually review that. So that was our counsel's concern, and I indicated that I would bring that up. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave, did you hear Brian's question that he was wanting clarification to earlier?
Representative Knopen, I think this was in response to Representative Nolan's question earlier.
No, it was the second change of the mortality table and whether it impacted the initial look back.
Right. The second change does not affect the initial look back. The way it's set up, it goes on forever. You're supposed to continually, it isn't limited only to those people who retire before any implementation of a new table. It's anybody who retires on or after July 1st, 2003, you have to do the calculation. And what that means is that you continue to look back, although if there is a new mortality table, unlikely, as I've indicated before in 2005, if there was one, you would still use that new mortality table for determining whether or not you met the standards for the preservation of the benefit calculated in 2003. And just to be clear on the other question that was raised, in looking at doing the look back calculation, as the way it's written, it says only two things are different in doing that calculation under 238.300. One is the account balance, and the other is the mortality tables, which means you use the then current age of the member in running that calculation. And that's, I think it's pretty clear in the bill, and I see the PERS people nodding back there. I think it's very clear that that's the way it works. You use the then current age, not the age of the member as of 2003, June 30th, 2003.
And then, Brian, you had a further issue with Section 4 that related to, you thought that police and fire may somehow be damaged Could you, Dave, I know was talking at that time to Steve, and I don't know if he heard your discussion.
Actually, that question probably is a more valid question for Steve Delaney to explain, because he's the one that explained to me how it, in fact, impacted police and fire folks, as it impacted anyone else. But the reality is, because police and fire use the full formula more than any other type of employee going out currently, my understanding is 87% of the people that go out and use money match, of the remaining 13%, police and fire are a larger percentage of those that are using that. So this new wrinkle of impacting the full formula has more of an impact on police and fire than it would anyone else.
Steve, I'd be happy to have you come up and talk about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Steve Delaney. You're correct. I didn't hear the question when I was talking to Dave. There isn't a difference between calculating a full formula for a PNF and general service other than an actual factor that's involved, the 2.0% for police and fire, the 1.67% for general service. The issues that we talked about, Brian, is this is our... It applied to all members, and it's the issue that this committee already heard, is that a change to a conversion to the factors by the member's choice. If a police and fire member wants to convert the basic benefit to some kind of annuity that covers her spouse, etc., no different for PNF than for general service, as was discussed by this committee.
Brian, did you have more, or were you?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Questions of
Brian? I'm exhausted.
You're exhausted. We're definitely exhausted. Thank you. And somebody was going to speak for the Employer Coalition. I believe that was Michelle Deister.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Here today representing the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon School Boards Association, and the Special Districts Association of Oregon, I'm Michelle Deister. First of all, we want you to know that, in our opinion, the amendments to House Bill 2004, the -11s, are a step in the right direction. However, we continue to support the full and immediate implementation of mortality tables. I believe, Mr. Chair, the other day you mentioned that you wanted to give us all time to be comfortable in our opposition to this particular approach. But we do want you to know that we continue to prefer the full and immediate implementation approach. We have a judge's decision that references that. Governor Kulongoski also referenced immediately beginning to, quote, use the most accurate and current estimates of mortality rates that we have seen, and that was at his January 23rd press conference. We don't support the contention by some that this is somehow a takeaway or that it's a deduction for PERS members. These mortality tables are out of date and they're inaccurate, and they basically, in our view, amount to a windfall that has resulted in unjust enrichment at the expense of local government services and taxpayers. Those services include fire protection and public safety for our communities. They include adequate infrastructure, education for boys and girls in classrooms, and all the county services, including protection from communicable diseases, care for the chronically mentally ill. These are all important issues, and certainly there are significant savings to be had with the alternative approaches. If your committee is committed to a look-back calculation, then we believe that the -11 calculation is the right approach for you to take. Freezing the account balances without additional crediting of earnings gets us closer to fully implementing these mortality tables and is the closest to full and immediate implementation, certainly closer than the board's proposal would get us. So we do support Chair Knope's assertion that a look back for future updates to the tables is unnecessary. If they're going to be updated periodically anyway, the effects should be lessened. What you have here is a situation where you've been using outdated mortality tables for such a long period of time that this look-back calculation is necessary at this time. So if that's the direction that this committee is committed to. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make certain, Michelle, in your penultimate paragraph there, you indicate that the look-back calculation, we believe that the approach contemplated in the dash 10 amendments is the right one?
I would like to amend that to say the dash 11.
You did say in your testimony dash 11.
I do want to clarify that having seen the dash 11s, we're comfortable with that approach.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to put anything on the record? No. Committee members, at this point, I think we've heard the various arguments that we're likely to hear. I don't believe anything will change. As it relates to the Department of Justice's advice, I chose not to avail myself to that because I don't think ultimately it was sound advice, because clearly the board is acting on it, and I don't think I don't believe that Judge Lipscomb would approve of where the board is headed. So clearly he did not. So with that, I would like to move forward on these amendments. I think we've put all the general objections on the record, and I don't see where those objections would cause any change at this point in this particular amendment or future amendments. And I believe those questions have been answered by PERS, unless anybody else has any other questions from the PERS agency or anyone else. Anybody? With that, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, we're in work session. I'd move the dash 11 amendments.
Representative Butler has moved the dash 11 amendments to House Bill 2004. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
I want to comment that although I appreciate your interest in moving forward, and I know we have much hard work ahead of us on other issues relating to PERS, I do think this is not quite ripe today for decision. I have very serious concerns that I would like to get answered and will get answered regardless of whether you move this bill today or not. But I think there's information out there that may influence members of the committee, and I don't see that waiting for 2 days to get that information compromises the effort to improve the PERS system. So I would object to both the amendment and moving the bill today.
Anyone else in terms of discussion? Colleagues, we can always bring the bill back if there's something materially that turns out different. But based on the testimony that we've heard, I just don't appear. I don't believe that that is the case. And we can delay, and go to dash 12, 13, 14, and 15. But in the end, I don't think materially it will change much from where we're at today. Nor do I think the legal advice is going to change much. So. I'm happy to take a roll call vote on the amendments and then take a vote on the overall bill as it's amended. So if there's no other discussion, I'll go ahead and call for the roll.
On the amendments?
On the amendments.
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Graham?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Kapori?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
And Chair
Knopf? Aye. The amendments have been adopted, and I now entertain a motion to move the bill.
Move.
Representative Butler has moved that House Bill 2004, as amended, be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I,
Representative Barker.
All right, Mr. Chair, I just have some, I'm going to support the bill. But I have some grave reservations in hearing things that that we're having legal advice that I'm not aware of, but I tend to agree with your conclusion that the bill will not change a great deal beyond this point. So,
thank you, Representative Barker. Anyone else?
I would note that I think this is, as I said before, I think this is as close to middle ground as you're going to get on this issue. I think it protects employees as it relates to the look-back provision. I think it protects employees as it relates to the prospective date as opposed to what would be a retroactive date. I think it gives the courts an opportunity to choose whether, in fact, retroactivity is accurate or not, or if, in fact, we found a remedy within the look-back that provides employees the opportunity essentially not to be damaged by moving to what already should have happened more than a decade ago, which is updating of the mortality tables. Clearly, in dollar terms, in terms of savings, this comes much more, much closer to the employer version than the PERS Coalition version. I appreciate the PERS Coalition putting their concerns on the record. Clearly, they're in a very difficult position, and I do understand that. And you know, nobody's interested in hurting anyone in this process. But we do end up having to move forward. We do have to deal with this issue. And ultimately, I think the issues that you're concerned about is not something for the legislature to answer, but I think it's ultimately something that the courts have to answer. And therefore, I think we should move forward with this bill, unless for some reason there is a change in the testimony that's been given in the next few days, and I'd be happy to bring the bill back to committee and change it at that time. But I just don't sense that at this point. And I would prefer not to delay and to move forward, because, in fact, we do have much difficult work ahead of us, including a new successor plan. And I'm confident that other folks want to deal with other bills such as 2003 and inactive accounts and other issues. And I really feel like that at this point the delay is not warranted. So with that and with the reservation that we can bring it back if there is something materially that changes in the next few days, I would commit to doing that. So if there's nobody else for discussion, I will have the roll called. Anyone else? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2004 is passed the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I suspect that probably no one will volunteer to carry this bill. So the chair will carry the bill, and would be happy to have any support whatsoever that the committee would choose to give the chair on the floor. And if folks have questions in the meantime, regarding this, we'd be happy to try to answer them. I know it's a complicated issue, and that some of your caucus members may be confused. Obviously we've gone through 11 variations of these amendments, and have, I think, split legal hairs on many occasions with these. So please feel free to send those folks to me, to Dave Hendricks, or to the PERS agency to get their questions answered before this bill appears on the floor. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, by way of voter explanation, let me say this. I am going to support the bill on the floor. I do reserve the right to come back and speak on the floor on behalf of the two coalitions. I think that they both have some justification for their positions, significant justifications. I don't think it's any secret to the chair that I do support the issues from the employer direction that indicate that, in fact, Judge Lipson's decision did indicate that we were to use immediate and full implementation of the law and his decision. And with that regard, I think that both parties, the both employers and employees, have come to half ground, middle ground here. and I appreciate the good work that they've done. Thank you.
Representative Butler, Chair appreciates your willingness to put things on the record on the floor. I think it is important. The judge would have specified a date that meant full and immediate, which would have left us not guessing at what that actually meant. But he didn't, and that's okay. We have dealt with it. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2004, and I have a hearing in recess on House Bill 2008. I'll reopen that to see if anybody else wanted to testify on House Bill 2008. I don't see anybody who wants to, testify on House Bill 2008. And I did have House Bill 2020 on for public hearing, so we'll open a public hearing on that. I don't see anybody who wants to testify on that one either. So we'll close the public hearing, and if there's nothing else to come before the committee is adjourned. Thank you. Okay.